Hello, everyone. This is Andrew. Welcome to Keen on America. On July 4th, 2026, America will be 250 years old, an anniversary that will, no doubt, be greeted with a mixture of celebration, contemplation, and resignation. In Keen on America, we talk to prominent U.S. citizens, not just about their country's past and present, but also about its future. What, I ask my American guests, will be the 21st century fate of their now venerable republic? If being American means getting stuff successfully done, then my old friend Chris Schroeder is the most authentic of Americans. Media executive, startup entrepreneur, political operative, investor. Chris Schroeder qualifies, in my view at least, as the most authentic of Americans. And I began our Keen on America conversation, as I always do with Chris, by asking him when and where he was born.
I was born in 1967 in New York City.
Do you think of yourself as an American?
I think of myself very much as an American. It's instructed by the fact that I am the grandson of Italian immigrants, and that was a part of the life. But even my grandparents thought of themselves as first and foremost as American, almost from the day they came.
What does that mean, though, to feel oneself an American? Do you mean because your grandparents were immigrants to New York?
I think that the idea of America is the idea. There is a sense that I think sometimes is mocked today, that you can come to a place where you really are free to experiment in many different ways. You can reinvent yourself in many different ways. And there's opportunity that hard work will reward. And for some reason, we're at a time where people seem to dismiss this. But my parents and grandparents were fanatics on this subject. They really came with absolutely nothing. I just found recently a memoir that my grandfather had kept in the early sort of 1911 era. And it was brutal for him. I mean, being an Italian American, there was a lot of racism, there were a lot of problems. And he just had a firm conviction that there were things to navigate, and you navigated them. But the blessing in America is it wouldn't keep you down. You could keep coming. And I think that very much was instilled in a sense of what it meant to be American, whether you go back to the Pilgrims or certainly the many immigrant communities that had populated New York from the late 1800s into the early 20th century.
I know you're very strongly influenced by your mother. When she died a few years ago, you had a very moving piece. Did your mother share your grandparents' sense of what it meant to be an American, or was there a generational quality each new generation thinks about being American differently? Your father as well, though.
I think it's a wonderful question about how generations think about what it means to be American, particularly from the immigrant experience, because what was interesting is while my grandparents thought of themselves very much as Americans, they were very Italian-American. Their community tended to be all of Italians, the people they hung out with were Italians. My mother's father was a politician. He was a party boss for the Republican Party in the Bronx, but he also was very close to LaGuardia, and he was actually worked very hard for Franklin Roosevelt, so an interesting mix. But most of the crowd that he dealt with were, in fact, Italians. I mean, there were some Yiddish and a Jewish community, an Irish community, but it was a bit that way. My parents came around, and all of a sudden, the horizons began to broaden. By coincidence, they both were kids of Italian immigrants, and they married, which I suspect made my grandparents also interestingly happy. But overarchingly, they definitely thought of themselves as an American with a tremendous heritage and culture and food that they thought helped make America richer. And by the time I came along, I had a very keen understanding of both generations because I'd watched them in action and I'd watched them talk. But by then, I was completely 100% American, instructed by the immigrant experience, instructed by the experiences they had. And to this day, when I visit Italy, I think I have a particular empathy and understanding for the people and the language and the culture because of that background. And yet there's no doubt either in my lens or the people who I'm with that I'm very much an American.
Do you think you got an American education? You went to some of the top schools, but you were also educated in New York City. Is there such a thing as an American education?
You know, I think at the time there was probably a theme of a Western education, right? I mean, there was a sense that there was a general things that you would read or that you would study that was very there. And I can remember at Harvard, we had some of the greatest scholars on China, and we had amazing scholars about different parts of the world. But even then, there was no, really, trying to think about this, there were no Chinese students, I think, in my year. There certainly were no Soviet students in my year. In fact, in the 90s, when I went to business school, I think I had the first Soviet student in the history of Harvard Business School in my section. And we also had four or five people from mainland China. And so some of it was just de facto, right? It was just the reality of the community there that leaned a little bit Western, particularly on the East Coast. But I think over time, you learn that the richness of the experience was a thing that was very, very powerful. And there were courses, of course, about the immigrant experience and things like that.
What was your experience like at Harvard? Obviously, today, Harvard is a particularly controversial place. Was it a pleasant experience?
I loved Harvard because it was a great fit. And there's a cliche that talks about that you learn as much from the students as you do from the academic environment and the professors. And that was my experience, because I could sit at a dining room table and have people come from, you know, most parts of the world. I had poets next to physicists, next to athletes, and it pushed me to get out of my comfort zone and to realize, I think in a very profound way, that I needed to learn quickly how to embrace being wrong. I think when you first get to a place like Harvard, everyone is trying to prove that they're right about everything and they know everything. And you get a very early lesson in humility, but also a lesson in saying, you know, being wrong is fantastic. Because if you're wrong, you can do better, and you can rethink the world, and you can reposition yourself to sort of lead into things, which is in the impossible task of understanding what truth was overall. So that element, I loved it. But Harvard then and now, and I think probably from the 60s on, was a very left of center leaning place. People like to express themselves politically, you know, in very passionate ways. That it certainly begun in a unique way in the late 60s during Vietnam. In my era, it was about apartheid in South Africa. Today, it's obviously a host of other issues. And, you know, I think at the end of the day, that was part and parcel of it, but it actually gave me an appreciation to respect less people who shut off other ideas, people who just shouted people down in presentations or speeches, which would happen infrequently, but too frequently. And it helped me double down in thinking that I wanted to find the people who actually were trying to have a wonder in being wrong and try to understand the other perspective to make themselves more effective. And there was plenty of that at Harvard then and now.
Do you think that's the ideal American education, to learn, to experience being wrong and learn from it?
I think it is something which is very powerful about the American opportunity in education. And I'll give you a concrete example. We had this marvelous young man stay at my house for a couple of weeks some years ago from Vietnam. And he was absolutely brilliant. And in almost a cliche, he ended up being the smartest math student within our school. I think he even got recognition in the Washington, D.C. area of being astounding. And I sat down with him once and I said, so what is it like to come here? Do you feel like the work is too easy or people don't work hard enough? He said, no, people work very hard. He said, but let me tell you, the experience that blew me away was not doing problem sets in math. I can do those things with rote learning. What blew me away was the engineering club. Because in the engineering club, I just saw an army of very smart people who were just making mistake after mistake and pushing each other to get to right answers and to build things concretely. He said, I can tell you a lot about mathematical problems. I can tell you a lot even about nuclear science, but I can't tell you much about application, because I was trained that you can't make mistakes, making mistakes is bad, and that you need to do rote learning. And I think one of the things which really sort of overlaps with one of the better aspects about America overall is that you embrace the idea that being wrong and making mistakes is part and parcel of coming up with collaborative answers, and you don't get penalized for it. And I think that is part of a distinct thing about America that, from an educational perspective, to your question about is there an American academic experience, I think it's less about a given course and more about a willingness to fail and to slip and to innovate and come up with better answers collaboratively. Now, I think sometimes, particularly today, but I experienced it some, you know, even when I was a kid overall, if you shut someone down and if you tell them that words they use are bad words, or the first thing comes out of your mouth labels you in a box some way, you're actually doing the antithesis of one of the things which I think has made our culture and our shared experience some of the best aspects of it.
Your childhood was time of great unrest in America, the end of the Vietnam War, Watergate, Carter, the crises of the 1970s. Were there events in your childhood that shaped your political understanding of the world, shaped perhaps your ideology, your Do you think of yourself politically in generational terms?
It's a fantastic question to think of oneself in generational terms politically. And I think the answer is that there are many sort of sub-examples of this. But there are really two foundational things in how I view the world today that was instilled in me growing up in the New York area in particular and as a grandson of immigrants. I mean, one was a hyper value of individuality. It doesn't mean that we can't lock arms and do things together because you have to. But the idea that if you have talent, it should be unleashed. And anything that one can do to knock the obstacle out of the unleashing of that talent is just absolutely foundational to what it means to be not just an American, but in my view, in the work I do today in a global sense, but certainly had an American immigrant patina to it growing up. The second thing was just sort of learning about the ability to see the mistakes of your society and see whether or not you can correct them. And so one of the first memories I have in a serious way, I mean, I sort of remember a little bit about Watergate, mostly because I couldn't watch the cartoons I wanted to watch because my mother was watching the Senate hearings. But what I really remembered a little bit more intelligently was when the hostages came back from Iran. And I actually cut school, I must confess. I forged a note to cut school because there was a ticker tape parade for the hostages in New York City that day. And I'd never been to a ticker tape parade either. And I thought this would be a great exciting moment, like John Glenn after coming back from space or end of World War II. So I slipped down to Lower Manhattan and I saw two things. I saw a very large parade with a lot of ticker tapes celebrating these poor women and men who really had not done anything heroic but to survive, which of course is amazing. But I'm sort of like, this is America? Like America at this stage in history in the early 80s is celebrating this? Like, is this a celebration or an honoring? How to think about it? But what really grabbed me was next to me, there were four men, quite loud and well drunk, and I realized that they were all Vietnam veterans. And they were saying, we never got this parade. Like, we were celebrating this, but you never gave us any kind of kudos. And it was a moment where I just thought about, where is America in the world today? Where is America's sort of legend built after World War II, formulating and going into a very different world going forward? And it gave me a sense of humility and an understanding that you had to be very flexible about things. I've become convinced that all of us get scarily locked down by experiences that then happen in our 20s. And I warn my friends in their 20s now, but I also warn people in their 40s and 50s to be very careful about this, because I think in our 20s we form a worldview of where we fit into the world and that sort of sticks with us. So for example, in my 20s, the Berlin Wall fell and America was sort of a singular, very important power. There was a sense that we as Americans had a system that everyone else would like to have, and it was part of our job to even help them have it in some form overall. Well, that's a very powerful idea, and there were elements of it that had truth to it, but a lot of elements had hubris and arrogance to it. We weren't understanding the ground on the ground's terms. And yet to this day, and you can see this among the sort of boomer generation leaders in Washington and the House and the Senate and the White House and whatever, they're acting as if it were still in the 90s, that America's place in the world is that place. I mean, when President Biden said, what was the first thing he said when he got elected was America's back. Well, to me, and back to what? It's a very different world with different constraints. Technology has allowed people everywhere in the world to express themselves in different ways, and they have their own approaches. And I think that now we're at a stage where we can think of America not in how I was sort of set in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s to think about it, but in a very, very new world where the watchword, I think, is more co-authorship. It's not you should follow us because we're, you know, high on the hill. There are many things that we do that are important, but there are many failures that we make. But there is a co-authorship. The best of different societies could be leveraged together if we actually put our minds to it and there's leadership who would embrace it.
You, as a 20-something, had a front row seat on history as it unfolded, dramatic events, the fall of the wall, you were involved with the Republican administration of the elder Bush. You worked with James Baker, you were as a young man. A couple of questions on that. Firstly, of course, the memories. And secondly, what led you to work for the Republicans rather than the Democrats? Or did you not really care, you just wanted to get into politics?
No, I cared, and I didn't just want to get into politics. I mean, you know, it was not an ideological thing. My mother and both my parents were Republicans, but a very different kind of Republican. My mother, again, her father had worked in a fusion ticket of LaGuardia in New York, and LaGuardia and my grandfather had supported FDR as Republicans. So she had a certain ilk of it. My father was more of what was viewed as a traditional conservative of sort of the Ronald Reagan or Barry Goldwater world. But these were not ideologues. They really wanted to talk through issues and understand them and think about them in very powerful ways. But I did have a very strong belief that, one, anything that could unleash the opportunity of individuality was important. That felt to me more Republican than Democrat. I felt the Republicans were a little bit more hard-nosed about thinking about our place in the world, and that was something that was very conducive to me. But in many respects, I joined the Bush father team at I was 21 years old. I was very young, because I liked the sense of pragmatism, the desire to meet people on their terms, to cultivate relationships with leaders around the world, not just because you wanted to convince them to do things your way, but because you knew they were incredibly important partners in what we were doing. And for whatever history will say about President Bush father and Secretary Baker, these were men who were deeply, deeply committed to these relationships and had formed them in many cases over decades. And there were many things that were formative to me as a kid watching these leaders at this time in history when the world was really jumping ahead in many, many different ways. But it was the cultivation that these men formed with relationships with other leaders that to me was one of the most powerful lessons, because it reaped such rewards at a period of time that we forget now could have gone deeply south and very problematic. And the other thing I would share with you about that experience is, I say this to people all the time, nothing prepared me for the internet more than working in the State Department at 21 years old at that time in history, not because of bureaucratic management, which was staggering, not because of technology, which was ancient, but because in an 18-month period, I pretty much saw everything about the world that I assumed my grandchildren would be living in evaporate. And it just knocked me back on my heels. I began to say to myself, the experts don't really always know what they're talking about. Things can move well beyond traditional backward-thinking expertise. The idea of 5 or 10-year career plans were crazy. This was an opportunity to almost rewire oneself, and that was a perfect timing for when the internet came. I just had that nature and curiosity and development which I brought to it with me.
You define your politics as pragmatism. Some people might think of that as a kind of ideology. Are there pragmatists, distinguished pragmatists in American history who for you are, if not heroes, models, Lincoln perhaps, Madison, Hamilton? Do you see yourself as part of that pragmatic tradition?
I do, very much. And I think Lincoln's a very good example of it. And I studied Lincoln very closely with one of the greatest living Lincoln scholars at the time, David Donald. And I particularly focus on international relations during the Civil War, which is not something that's well really reported on. And I got to watch Lincoln and his sense of pragmatism and realism a very powerful way. To the degree I have heroes, George Marshall was a hero of mine both in World War II and as a Secretary of Defense. And I will tell you that I admired unbelievably Baker and Bush as, you know, kind of a continuum on this. Everyone has their problems, being these leadership roles mean that you're going to have challenges and what have you. But I like the attitude that was sort of underpinning the pragmatism, and there's a balance involved in it. The underpinning is, I am going to try to understand the ground on the ground's terms. It's not merely me saying, you ought to be this way because I think this way, or if I were in your shoes, you would think this way. It is, I'm really trying to understand how you think about things on your terms, because with that, you can be very practical. The mistakes in history are very often, not just in America, but elsewhere, where one country assumes the other country is behaving with a series of premises that is the way they think about things, or they think it's the way they ought to. And I look at people like Lincoln and like George Marshall and Baker and Bush as people who really had a sense of trying as best they could, just very hard from Washington, to sort of sense what is the world where it's happening. Now, the trip is that if you're overly pragmatic, then you can start driving through rearview mirrors, and you have a pragmatism that's based on premises that may be changing. And one of the things that I admired about them was their understanding that this was a very different world that we had to frame differently. It wasn't just about going back. It was very much about, okay, there are new parameters here. What are our interests? What are the things that matter? But how can we actually lead in a new environment? And honestly, I wish we saw more of that. The incentive structure of Washington then and now, but more so now, is about how full your inbox is in the short term. And to be a pragmaticist who can look forward, you have to get out of the short-term inbox and think medium, long-term in parallel. And that to me is the essence of what pragmatism is. It's not just looking back on 2 + 2 = 4. It is sort of saying, okay, where is the puck, proverbial puck, going as well?
The American system, of course, is, some people might argue, is built for pragmatists, because That's the only way you get anything done. Lincoln, perhaps FDR, certainly Marshall and Bush and Baker. Is for you pragmatism, the art of, not the art of the deal, the art of compromise, and is that another an American quality because of the structure of American government, of the division of powers?
To think about the political dynamic and the sort of give and take and the compromise as an essence of America as it has been, and the questions that we need to raise now is actually a profound question, because I think one of the magics of the American system throughout is this sense of, at the end of the day, we may not always get 100 cents on the dollar. In fact, you never get 100 cents on the dollar. The goal here is to say you've got very smart people with very different interests and different perspectives, and the compromise is what has made democracy do one of the most important things, which often fails in other governance, which is to correct or to self-correct. And in absence of that sense of compromise, that sense of saying, you know, I can't get it my way every way, I think has been one of the magics for the challenges of America that's made it very powerful and distinct. And of course, we're in an era right now where that kind of pragmatism, that kind of compromise is not rewarded. Your person on the other side of the aisle is your enemy, or you want the tactics of wins. You don't want to give a win to anybody else. You know, I think the media plays a role where we don't understand that actually a lot of compromise does still happen, certainly at the state and local level, but even here. But for the most part, this sense that, you know, I may not win this one, but someday I'll get what I want here, but as long as you get something here, we can figure out ways to solve problems. Let's just say that's not quite in the ethos, not only here, but I think around the world right now.
Chris, some people might be watching this and saying, well, he's a white guy, white upper class guy, educated at Harvard, and so pragmatism works for him, that there are profound problems in American history, of course, race, slavery, the issue of gender, and so on, as you've heard all this stuff before. And sometimes one has to go beyond pragmatism. So FDR, for example, was a supremely pragmatic politician, never really addressed the issue of race in America. Are there times when American politics requires more than just pragmatism?
Well, I'm not sure how pragmatism fits into the definition of these very, very long stand issues that we have before, as so much as it is a sense of really empathy and understanding. And I think one of the things that happens is that folks can't see other folks on their terms comfortably. And so they think people should act the way that they act or think that the way that they think. And that becomes very, very difficult. I would suggest that Martin Luther King and many of the great leaders of the civil rights movements were incredible political pragmatists. They understood very much the leverages of power and when to use it and not to use it in very powerful ways, and they made progress, but obviously there are things that we need to do in a different way. Then it becomes a debate about the how. And for me, this is where I spend much of my life, both globally with tech startups, but I think about it from a policy perspective all the time, is what can we do as society constantly keep knocking out barriers to allow excellence from people from whatever walk of life they come from. If there's a barrier that keeps them in education or whatever from being able to actualize their ideas and thinking or their desire to participate in a community, that to me is the essence of what we need to be thinking about. The other problem that comes with the question that you asked is that it kind of balkanizes us. There's a presumption that all one people think one way and have the same shared experience. And that is not really, I think, America's never really been a melting pot. I think there's always been some factionalization that's had to be navigated, and some of it important as a base of political power. But at the same time, the great moments happen when people say to themselves, look, there are things that are different, and there are penalties I'm receiving in my desire to build something new because of my race or color or religion or background or geography, whatever it may be. But what is it also that makes us Americans collectively? Because in there we can find the solutions. And we'll have to see how this plays out. These are very sensitive issues and they're very complicated.
Speaking of what makes us Americans, you spent a lot of your career in tech. Of course, the history of America is very much bound up with innovation, from Edison and Ford up into Marc Andreessen, who I know is a friend of yours. Do you see your career in tech as, again, part of your Americanness? Is there something about your education, your upbringing, your parents, the world you grew up in, that lends itself to a career in innovation?
I think that there's a dynamic that we've been talking about the ability to think beyond yourself, to not only understand the pragmatics of how to get things done, but to think big about the world, that has been very much part and parcel of America since its founding overall, and technology can be another manifestation of it. And so as I've met some of the women and men that I really admire in this space, they're constantly pushing me not only about a given technology thing, because at the end, technology is a tool of facilitation to make massive change and reach in ways that we couldn't do before, but they get you to think differently. So I'll give you an example. There was some year, I know he's not a friend, but I happened to just be with Larry Page from Google a few years ago, and he sort of said something that really struck me in passing. He said, you know, of course, one day we'll be able to fly to Tokyo in an hour. I'm like, wow, do you know something I don't know? He said, no, it's not that I've seen any technology that'll have us do this now. But he said, there's nothing in physics that says that we can't. That sentence is an incredible sentence. There is no inherent limitation. Therefore, we should be able to think about it and figure out ways to get to it overall. Interestingly, of course, he's an immigrant, but I would say that that is something that is sort of embellished and used in very pragmatic ways. It is not credited enough for people to become very anti-tech for reasons which I think are really foolhardy. Because while there are always going to be good and bad actors in any field overall, this mentality of there is no structural impediment to making it happen other than our imagination. And that's something that not only is very powerful, that has come from innovators, whether in pre-technology or in Silicon Valley or the stuff that's happening around the country today, I do think it's quite distinctly American. I can't tell you the number of times I've been friends with Europe who from time to time I'll say, they'll be uptight about something and I'll throw out some idea about how technology could solve it, and they look at me for a minute and get a big smile on their face. And so that's the difference between you and us. You guys keep thinking about how whatever problem we see could be solved in some way. And look, there's amazing innovation and problem solving coming from every place in the world. But I do think this essence that we're talking about, the mindset we're talking about, is not only special in America, but is something that is distinctly American.
You had a front row on the fall of the wall and the end of the Cold War. You also had a front row seat for the beginnings of the internet. You were the CEO of Newsweek, Washington Post Online. What are your memories of that? Do you feel as if you or guys like you missed an opportunity to embed media in our new digital age?
It's a wonderful question about did we miss an opportunity to embed media in a different way, and I think in a way it ties many of the things that we've been talking about here, because very much the mindset in and around that era 20 years ago, 15 years ago, of how news should be in the future, for example, content writ large, was very much about a replication of that which had been. I can remember editors referring to the internet as the 15th printing press or whatever. So there was a sense that whatever we're doing it fine. And we're not asking a lot of big questions about, one, what kinds of new opportunity could we have that are innovative? Or at the same time, you know, what are challenges we should be thinking about in advance that we want to ask ourselves, that we don't want to sleepwalk towards them, but there are things going to be real. And I remember I used to give a speech, this is more like 8 or 9 years ago, and it was a very provocative speech, and it's more from the advertising side of it. But I talked to a large audience once. I said, okay, folks, I want you all to pretend that the internet came first. Now go sell television advertising or print advertising. And there are two lessons in that. Lesson one is we should be asking ourselves, if certain things happened first, if we weren't just locked down to the legacy, what could we unleash now if we decided we wanted to unleash it? That's a very powerful question, because we have a gravitational desire to take that which exists and make it more efficient with technology, and not necessarily thinking about the big step that could really make difference in people's lives. And the other lesson, which I learned a lot in the media at that time, is here we are 10 years after I gave that talk, and the fact of the matter is even YouTube has 30-second spots now, and the Super Bowl ads are still sold out for billions of dollars. And so behavioral change comes slowly, and people are comfortable with what they're comfortable with. And the problem is, in that comfort, we'll keep getting what we thought we had, but things can change in dynamics that we're missing those changes, both positive and some of them which, of course, have become negative.
Your life has very much taken place within the period between the 200th and 250th anniversary of the Republic. What are you most proud of in the 50 years between 1976 and 2026?
I think
in terms of America, of course.
Look, I think that the element of self-correction is still very much there, and I think we went through some very, very difficult times even right before 1776. I mean, people forget 1968, I think, makes this year look like this is a time of peace and stability. I mean, we go through these periods and we get very worked up, and this is the worst of whatever that's ever happened before, and yet we kind of muscle through it and we think about things in different ways. And we forget that the time when I described before, I was thinking about the period of the Iran hostages. I mean, at the same time, you know, Russia invaded Afghanistan. We had a war on the verge throughout the Middle East. We had different kinds of conflicts and issues in the environment. We had interest rates that were well into the double digits. We have an economy that looked like it'd be stagnant forever. There were riots in the streets in England. I mean, it's we have to remind ourselves that the ability to self-correct and to push each other hard, but at the same time understand that we can keep moving forward, is something which I'm very proud of. That's still an element of America in this 50 years. And I must say, technology is a major component of it. The fact is that people are living longer. We are killing each other less writ large. We are doing many, many things which are very powerful because of the innovative nature, not just of America, but what we've learned from elsewhere. But the job is never over. And obviously we have many concerning things right now, that it's not clear that my answer would be the same if I were around for the 300th. I mean, these are choices. Democracy and an American system and unleashing individuality is hard, sustained work. And it's very easy to not only fall back on sort of what makes us comfortable, but to also have ADD, which is we know that something is important, we know we should go at it, but it doesn't get solved in a hashtag, it doesn't get solved in a TikTok video, it'll take years. And I think that one of the things that we have been able to do in the past is have medium and long-term commitment to issues. And we have to see going forward for the next 50 years if we can bring some of that back, because not all of our answers are going to be solved by yelling at each other in a TikTok video.
For your children's children and their children's children, what do you think people will most remember about the period between 76 and 26?
I think that our grandchildren will look back at us, and in many different ways, the answer to how they judge us will be determined maybe in the next 5 years. Because we could be making decisions about not addressing issues or allowing ourselves to sleepwalk in how we are as global citizens, as well as issues that need to be addressed here at home, that the jury, I think, is just frankly still out. I'm not sure that they'll look back and say, how are things from 1976 to 2026? They're going to be asking ourselves what choices were made in a period of unbelievable shift in the world economy and the world political environment. Did we or did we not stand up and do the auto-correcting that I've described before, which has been the best part of the American democracy previously? And so the jury is out. It's utterly solvable. You and I were talking a little bit about homelessness in San Francisco. 7,000 people are suffering terribly in San Francisco. Hundreds of thousands of people are suffering because of crime and other elements there. In the most beautiful city in America, one of the most beautiful cities in America, with some of the most innovative problem-solving people around it and plenty of wealth. We don't figure these basic things out across America, and our kids and grandkids inherit cities like that overall, they're gonna be asking a lot of questions about how we muffed it. And I think that's the jury's still out on this question.
You said to me earlier before the camera started rolling that you're politically homeless. Does that concern you, for a pragmatist like yourself, a man of the center, classic centrist, that you don't feel comfortable in either party, in the Democratic Party of Joe Biden or the Republican Party of Donald Trump?
Yeah, it concerns me very greatly about where I think about politically, but I must say the label centrist is concerning me as left or right. I am pragmatic in nature, which means I want to size up an issue on its facts. And step one for me is just to get to the facts and talk to expertise, to be contemplative, to not be visceral, to not try to get a bunch of likes in whatever social media I am, but to get deep into the essence beyond all this stuff so I can understand that. And if the answer makes sense, why label it left, right, or center? These are answers that make sense that can actually take care of so many obvious issues that we know that we're suffering from right now, for which our grandchildren will look back at us like they won't understand us. They will not understand how we found these things acceptable or these problems acceptable. So at the end of the day, I don't like any of the labeling. I like, at the end of the day, a sense of what is it you believe in. Now, I've always been an admirer of the bicameral party system overall, because there are a good collection of people who believe government activism is important to build a greater society, which tends to be more Democrat. and a more individuality approach and unleashing of sort of business and innovation, which historically has been more of the right of center side in a Republican Party. But both those definitions barely exist right now in the way they're defining themselves, because I think political parties have become a means to organize a certain group of people to win political power in the short term and to keep the other side from getting any power at all. This is a bipartisan affliction. People like to say this is all the Republicans doing it, but that's not my experience. It's a way the game and the incentive structure of politics is being played. But the fact is, this is not a game, and this is not a fuzzy time. And so, you know, my naive hope is not that we move to the center per se, because I'm not even sure I could define it. My hope is that we can actually breathe and have serious conversations about serious issues with some sense of nuance. Now, one will argue that never in the history of American politics has that been purely the case, and that's fine, right? We had members of Congress beating each other with sticks right before the Civil War. So, I mean, these are hard and complex issues, and human beings are human beings. But I think we're in almost a silly period now. I think our leaders look silly in the way that they're not prioritizing the things that really matter, not only for today, but for the years coming.
Some people who have been on this show have suggested that 2024 represents an existential crisis threat to American democracy. Do you agree?
I don't agree with it at a degree, which is, at the end of the day, American democracy is always at threat if we take it for granted. And it is very hard, if you are, you know, serious about history, to look back at certain periods of our history in 1968, or in Watergate, or in 1979, or other periods, and say to ourselves, in 1989, things could have gone in so many different directions that could have had ramification on global democracy. And I think the lesson is a lesson of humility, which is to say that it is always something that we have to renew. It is always something that we have to take for granted. And if we don't look at it that way, what ends up happening is that the other side will do things which, quote unquote, can threaten democracy as well, but we're willing to give them a buy because we assume this side is the one who's actually taking care of democracy. I don't see it that way. I see right now, because of the incentive and desire for people to attain power at almost any cost, both sides are losing their innovation and edge to think about how we can have a sustainable democracy. And by the way, and this is very important, I think people lose track that democracy is not just sort of a construct for which your version of it and mine might be a little bit different. It is about governance, and governance is about delivering the goods. And I think the biggest threat to democracy right now is less about how spun up we get to each other, and more about an idea that a very large number of reasonable people here and around the world look at their capitals and they say to themselves, it's at best incompetent, and at worst an insider-rigged game. And by the way, there's evidence for both. And as long as governments does not deliver the good, seems irrelevant, seems to line their own pockets, or take care of themselves in whatever micro game that they have, that's the threat to democracy. Because who would not say at the end of the day, if this is no good, I'm willing to try almost anything else. And to me, we need to keep our attention as much on governance and excellence in delivering the goods and unleashing the kind of talent innovation that I've described before, as we do thinking ourselves, it's me against them, it's Republicans versus Democrats. And you never hear people talk about it. They talk about politics being broken, and there's no doubt there are many ways we should be rethinking many elements of our politics, but no one will talk about the hard stuff, which is governance and delivering the goods. We have 6 months till the next election. You're not gonna fix governance in 6 months, so the game tends to go back to the game, but we are just gonna be in a cycle of this if, in fact, we are not making government effective for the 21st century.
You've been in government. Some of your heroes are from government, people who make things happen, Lincoln, Marshall. How do we find those quality people who the people will trust? Or is it a two-way thing? Do the people need to rethink how they think about trust and leadership? Where are the leaders, Chris, of the future for America?
You ask about where the leaders are for the future of America, at least from a political sense of it. Needless to say, part of my argument is a lot of impact and a lot of leadership is coming outside of government by people being very innovative, maybe in government at the state or local level in the case of the United States, but also amazing activities that are coming out in innovation that are coming from scientists and technology and stuff like that. But the fact is, politics matters. Policy and governance matters. They've got the guns. They've got the ability to move things in ways that are incredibly important. And I fear that we're in a tautology, because at the end of the day, if you're a high quality woman and you want to get things done, I will define just for the purposes of this answer, The definition of high quality is a desire to be in an environment where you can concretely make measurable difference in what you've done, not just win re-election, but make measurable difference in what you want. Who is good, would want to put themselves and their families into the hashing machine that has become the American political system there. So then you have a tautology, because you have people who are willing to put up with that, which are the very people, very often than not, that will help perpetuate it, because there's an incentive to perpetuate it. Having said that, I'm a pretty hopeful man. And I must say, while the new generation is kicking up a lot of people who are playing this game as just as much as their elders are, I have met some amazing women and men, many of whom have been in service in the military, but others have just been in service in their communities, who are saying to themselves, it's time for something different. And if we can break the tautology and we start having a new generation of women and men who really are technocratic, are really thinking about problem solving and measurability, maybe we could bring ourselves into an autocorrect. It's very hard in this year to see a path to that in any way that's moving, but it's not like it's not there in ways that is often not covered in the media. And I think we should spend a lot of time thinking about things that are working in governance around America today that do work, and about the individuals who are leading that, and how those case studies we can perpetuate into new areas. I'll never forget meeting some people in law and order in East Palo Alto and in Long Island. Both were very crime-ridden areas. And both these folks, in very engaged ways, were able to not only drop the crime rates in their areas, but they also dropped the number of people going to jail. And if I were an expert of crime, of which I am not at all, I would be saying to myself, okay, what's the lessons? What can we do with that? How can we replicate that in multiple ways? And by the way, who are the women or men who made that happen? And can we start putting focus on them as the next generation of leaders? This is not an environment that lends itself easily to what I'm asking for, but it is where there is some seed of hope.
Is there room for Larry Page's thinking in politics? Larry Page, of course, you referred to earlier, who believed that because it's possible, there eventually will be a one-hour flight from America
to Tokyo.
Do we need more Larry Page-like thinking in American politics?
I think it's important that you rephrase to it as sort of Larry Page-like thinking. I'm not one of these people who think the next hot new business executive or technologist should become president of the United States, because running the country and running being a senator or a member of Congress is a very different kind of a role that has different kind of expertise. But you ask wisely about the mindset. And I think that there are things in the incentive structure in American politics which does not reward the idea of thinking medium and long term. And that's the essence to the mindset, which is, look, I don't even know if I could do it right now. I don't even think we can do it in 3 years. But there's nothing in the end that says if we want to do it, we can't do it. And the challenge, I think, in a lot of governance around the world in democracy is an inability to say, I think beyond my inbox, and I think it's very hard for me to think beyond the next election, which means by definition it's very hard for me to think beyond 2 or 3 years out. And the way the incentive structure of politics is, if you do campaign on those who work for them, they don't help you get elected in the next round. They don't help you raise a dollar. I can't run on something that I'm going to do in 5 years and raise money on it, or to win a primary about it and whatever. So I think we have to spend a lot of time looking at the incentive structure and our governance structures and say to ourselves, yes, that mentality would be enormously useful in America. I mean, President Kennedy dreamed about going to the moon, 9 years before we did it, 8 years before we did it. That is important, and there are some elements of it. We need to unleash it, but realize that there are structural impediments to it, not in our imagination or mind, but in the incentive structure of how you succeed in governance and democracies today.
Kennedy, you bring up Kennedy's ambition to land on the moon, which required huge investment and work from government. You also mentioned George Marshall, the Marshall Plan. Lots of people talk about new Marshall plans. As you look forward to the next 50 years after 2026, for the next 50 years of American history, is there a single area, Chris, where there is a need for a moon initiative, a Manhattan plan, a Marshall plan?
You know, in terms of the needs, there are two observations I'd make about, is there a need for a Marshall Plan or a future sort of big one shot that's a concerted effort that could rally ourselves. And I want to remind folks, because often I hear this when I'm abroad, like in a democracy, you can't build things in democracy. And what they're effectively saying, which has some truth to it, which is what I was talking about earlier, which to build things, you need to have a vision that are multi-year, maybe even multi-decade. And that is hard in democracy as structured today. But we have to remind ourselves that the element of some short-term incentive has always been a part of democracies. It's part of the trade-off that we make. And do not tell me that a democracy can't build in an organized, interesting frame way. Now, the Panama Canal was built by a democracy for all intents and purposes. As you point out, the Marshall Plan came from an American democracy overall. Putting man on the moon was doing that. This is right in our immediate lifetime. The United States of America was the only country to come up with a vaccine for COVID in a speed that no scientist would have predicted 18 months before we did that, and policymakers played a role in that. It wasn't just science innovation that was unleashed. There were people who decided to knock out regulatory hurdles and pushed it. It wasn't pretty or perfect, but it's astounding in hindsight what we have to think about. And so I think it's less about saying we need a Marshall Plan of some massive shot, because this shouldn't be just viewed as putting a lot of money into a government bureaucracy that can figure things out. I think it's really about government and governance saying to ourselves, what can we do in almost every act that we can to unleash the potential of individuals we have it and throw gasoline on solving the problems that we really care about? Because these ideas will come from anywhere. They'll come from very surprising sources overall. And I think you need a new mindset. The idea that a democracy should be just building big projects, there are elements of capital structure that require that, because we want it as a society and business can't afford it or what have you. But I think the bigger challenge is to say, you know something, we just have a tremendous amount of talent bottom up, and we should be doing what we can to unleash that. There was a woman from Egypt who said a wonderful thing to me when I wrote my book about tech and innovation in emerging markets, and in the Middle East in particular. She said the problem with top-down institutions, big governments, big NGOs, and that kind of stuff, they think as people, as problems to be solved. You poor people, we here in Washington will solve you. And there's an element of that in some of the big projects we were talking about before. But the opportunity now, because of what technology has unleashed, is what she calls the bottom up. And what she means by that is that the bottom up mindset is not people are problems to be solved. People are assets to be unleashed. And I think in some respects in the next 50 years, that is the core gating factor of how we think about what can be built and fixed going forward. But there's a lot of gravitational pull in politics to sort of keep people down. And that's foolish.
Final question, Chris. You haven't talked specifically about global warming or the environment. Given America's remarkable innovation, its technological resources, its universities, its access to capital, its internationalist or traditional internationalist government or culture, isn't it, if not obvious, certainly strongly arguable that the real challenge for America over the next 50 years is to solve the crisis of the environment, which threatens the entire planet, not just America?
I mean, it's the global warming stuff is not only incredibly significant to be thought of and understood for what it really is, because if you don't understand the problem, or I should say many problems, it's very hard to come up with solutions that's useful. And needless to say, like many of the things we've talked about today, the political environment tends to put people in different divides, that if you don't believe this liturgy and this liturgy, somehow or other, you're missing the point. And not enough, I think, people saying, what is it that we really understand? What are the facts? What are the problems that we have? And we have an opportunity to go at those in a thoughtful and deliberate way. And I will say, to something that's been a theme of much of this conversation, the new generation will have none of it. I think people my age and older who think, well, we can just keep kicking this can down the road, are missing not only something which is incorrect because it's important for us as a society globally, but because there's a whole new generation that demands it, understandably. But again, even of that younger generation of us, there has to be a sort of a right setting of what is to be prioritized in that sector, which leads to the obvious next set of it, which opens up other complicated doors. We can't do it alone under any circumstance. A global issue like this that has to be done globally has to be done globally thoughtfully, and it is almost impossible to think about this in a serious way and not think about India and China, for example. That means, by definition, democracies have to sit at the table with non-democracies to think about what is it that's pragmatic, because we all share the elements of it in very thoughtful ways.
And as your kids grapple with this, and final question, can they learn from your parents or your grandparents?
I hope that they learn a tremendous amount from my parents and grandparents. They certainly...
In a generational sense.
Yes, in a generational sense, because we all know this. I think everyone that you talk to at our age or even very young had a very special relationship with the grandparents, distinctive of parents and distinctive of their teachers and their mentors and what have you. And I think in many respects that comes not only from a sense of empathy and a shared family, But it comes because we can look at that generation and say, you know, these guys came through depression, they came through war, they came through multiple wars, they came from unbelievable societal unrest. Some of the things that were major, major problems unimaginable to fix when they were children were fixed. Many that we thought would be fixed are not fixed. It gives them a sense and a lens that the idea is you can fix things, that you can unleash individual potential to make a difference in the world, and you have to just keep showing up and persevere. And I think that's extremely powerful.